KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My name is Mike Hagan. You're listening to Radio Orbit. We'll be back in just a few minutes. We'll be right back. Good evening to you. Good morning to you. Good day to you. Whoever you might be, wherever you might be as you listen to this radio program, welcome to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My name is Mike Hagan. It's good to be here with y'all tonight, and I'm very excited about the show. But first, as always, quick thank you to Corey, New Wave Radio Theater. Every week, 1 hour before this program, Corey plays your wonderful theater on the radio. New Wave Radio Theater with Corey, 10 o'clock every Monday night. Before that, Kelvin and Eric the Red doing it up. Jazz plus blues equals release the spiders. Tech Radio at 6 p.m., keeping us up on the fast-moving and changing world of high technology. And, of course, Jeff Wheeler starts things off with Uncommon Light, 3 to 5 p.m. every Monday. Good music, good talk, good news. A cold Monday night, although hints of spring in the air for sure. New moon on the 7th, and the full moon equinox a couple weeks after that. So, at any rate, another good night to cozy up with Radio Orbit, the 3rd of March, coming on the 4th. You're listening to it here on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM, your imagination station. And I'm glad to be here with y'all and a part of it. Okay, thanks to everybody who joined us last week. The usual thank you to Richard Allen Miller. Fun talk with Rick, as always. We also heard a mix of music, including one song, I guess, last week by the band who I'll be featuring tonight. They're called D Numbers. By the way, all the musicians featured on the program can be found on the website right over there in the music archive section, okay? If you missed the show last week, I should say, or any other for that matter, you can always hear them after the deed. They're all on the web, www.MikeHagan, H-A-G-A-N, MikeHagan.com. In the program archives, you take a look around in there, I got a notion you'll find something you like. If you do, share it with someone else if you feel the need, okay? All right, tonight, just you and me for the most part. However, hold on, I got to adjust my microphone here. Wow, you hear that? That's better. Okay, anyway, tonight we don't have a live guest, and I've got some things that I'd like to talk about a little bit later maybe, and maybe we'll open the phone lines, but I'd also, I sort of just decided to do this afternoon, but I'm going to play an old audio piece in honor of the 37th anniversary of the experiment at La Churrera, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that if you're not familiar with what that was. Anyway, we'll hear this piece of audio called True Hallucinations, which is my old friend Terrence McKenna describing the first-hand account of he and his brother Dennis in the jungles of Colombia during the period between February 20th and March 20th or so, 1971. I've played this piece once before on the air, I think, but it's a classic, and there are certainly those of you out there who have never heard it, and for those who have heard it before, well, it's fun to hear again for most, I imagine. So we'll do that in just a little bit here. True Hallucinations, the accounts of an amazing experience and series of experiences in the Amazon with two brothers, Terrence and Dennis McKenna, some 37 years ago tonight, as a matter of fact. Okay. All right, we'll do space weather in a little bit here, a few other things in the news, and we'll hear some music from this band, D Numbers. All the tracks I'm playing tonight are from a CD called Light Parade. We started the show off with a song called Adelaia, and I'm going to play another one here called Xylem Up in just a second. Great music. These guys are great. I saw them in town here in Columbia, I don't know, maybe a month and a half ago or so. And I forget the young man's name who I met. But anyway, he was nice enough to give me a copy of the CD. And so we're hearing that tonight. D Numbers from their disc called Light Parade. This is a song here called Xylem Up. I'll play this and get my P's and Q's in order here, and then come back and see what else we can dig up, okay? All right, so it is Mike Hagan. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. And once again, D Numbers. Back with you in just a few minutes. KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Welcome back to the program, everyone. It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit. That's Xylem Up, D Numbers from their disc Light Parade. And you can check them out on the web at D Numbers, just the letter D, Numbers, NUMBERS.com, DNumbers.com. An interesting band writing some pretty cool music. So anyway, we'll hear some more from them throughout the program tonight. Thanks to the guys for getting me that music and allowing me to share it with my friends here. Okay? All right. Hi, everyone listening to us this evening on KOPN over the traditional airwaves or over the Internet, live or otherwise. Every Monday, we broadcast the program from the lovely studios here of KOPN in lovely downtown Columbia, Missouri. And we stream the show live as well on the web, kopn.org. Just click on the Listen Live button. You'll get a nice 64K stream anywhere on the planet. As long as you've got a decent Internet connection, you can hear the program and the radio station in general from anywhere with a nice web connection, okay? All right, thanks to everybody who makes that possible, live on the radio and on the net. Speaking of the net, thanks to my good friend Larry Noriger, the web wizard. Big thanks to Larry, as always. New web design for the springtime here, and we're sort of tweaking it as we speak. In fact, just sort of chatting about it in the chat room right there. Larry's in there tonight. Anyway, great stuff, and I like the new look, and we'll try to add some features and some content on the front page there, make it a little bit more friendly. But at any rate, we're checking things out in a new way this spring. So I'm glad for those who are liking the new website. Thanks for your comments. And for those who have had some difficulty with it, just to bear with us, and we'll see what we can do to keep improving it, okay? All right. Thanks as well to people out there sending art, music, poetry, etc. Lots of catching up to do, I realize, but if you're an artist of any variety, get in touch with me, and we'll figure out a way to share your art. Find a place for it on the website and make it available to anyone else who's interested in checking it out. As a matter of fact, I was hanging around this weekend, and there's the big film festival in town here, the True False Film Festival, which is becoming quite a to-do in the film independent film circles. But at any rate, there were lots of artists and filmmakers in town, and I had a chance to talk with some really interesting visual artists over the weekend. I met a painter named Lisa Ensing, who was super talented and really interesting artist. And anyway, I'd like to share some of her stuff with y'all in the next few months. But at any rate, there's just amazing stuff happening out there, and if you want to share it with us, you know, feel welcome, and we'll, you know, try to share it with other people, okay? All right, if you want to see what I'm talking about, go on over there to the website, okay? It's www.mikehagan.com. You'll have access to everything we're doing. Please share your thoughts with us. The email address and a quick, easy way to send email to me is available right there on the front page. There's also a forum/bulletin board that's always busy and interesting, and we have a live chat room that's up and active every Monday night and any other time of the week if you choose. Thanks, as always, to my friend Chaos for putting the whole chat thing together. It's wonderful, and it's just worked out great for the last few months since we've been using that. So anyway, I'll sneak over there for questions and comments as we move through the program tonight, and I always encourage guests as well as listeners to join us over there in the chat room and in the forum. It's a great way to see what other people that are sort of like mind or otherwise are up and at, okay? All right, my email address, orbitradio, O-R-B-I-T-R-A-D-I-O, orbitradio@AOL.com, and send me email. Love to hear from you, okay? Same thing with the guests and musicians that appear on the program. If you got the gumption, send any of us a note. We'd love to hear from you, okay? Once again, on the web, Mike Hagan, H-A-G-A-N.com. And the phone number here in the studio, pardon me, and the phone number here is area code 573-874-5676. If you want to give me a buzz sometime later during True Hallucinations or something like that, you can always call, and I'll have a chance to talk with you tonight, because we'll be playing a recorded piece that's about an hour long. Okay. All right. Let me tell you a little bit about some upcoming guests, and then we'll... do space weather, okay? All right, tonight Yours truly, I'll be with you, and we're going to do sort of a tribute show to Terrence and Dennis McKenna with regard to their amazing adventure in 1971 in the Amazon rainforest that was eventually dubbed the Experiment at La Chorrera. And we'll hear a piece called True Hallucinations, some spoken stuff from Terrence, who just an amazing person and someone who, if you're not familiar with, maybe you should check him out. He was a friend of mine, and his younger brother, Dennis, is still a good friend and someone who's been on the program a number of times, and just remarkable people. And this particular period of time in March of 1971 was essentially the formative period that sort of, not sort of, but fully shaped both of those men's careers for, well, for the rest of Terrence's life, which ended in the year 2000, and continuing with his brother Dennis, who's just a remarkable person and a amazing neurochemist and ethnopharmacologist and plant biologist, and also a shaman of a very, very high order, whether he recognizes that or not sometimes, I think. But at any rate, Terrence and Dennis McKenna, we'll hear a little bit about their story tonight in just a little bit at the top of the hour. And that'll go from midnight till about 1 o'clock or so. And then I think for the rest of the program, I'd like to share with you some of my own personal experiences with regard to psychedelic shamanism and the techniques of archaic shamanism. Okay? All right, so that's what we're going to do tonight, all right? The week after this is the 10th of March. Dr. Gordon Pedersen, the chief science officer at American Biotech Labs, will be with me. I'm very excited about it. We're going to talk about silver and lots of different potential applications of this amazing, amazing element, I guess is the word I'm looking for. So, Chief Science Officer, American Biotech Labs, Dr. Gordon Pedersen next week. Dr. Martin Ball on the 17th of March. That is St. Patrick's Day. And Martin Ball is a really interesting fellow. I actually was involved in an interview on another radio program that's called the Sea Realm. Real cool guy, does a show called Sea Realm. His name is Kamo. But anyway, he's the host of that program. And a few months ago, Kamo interviewed me and Martin Ball together, and we had a real interesting conversation between the three of us. So anyway, I thought it would be a nice opportunity to have Martin Ball on this program and have a chance to talk with him for a couple hours. So we'll do that on the 17th of March, and you can check him out on the web. He's a really interesting writer and a musician as well. He'll be playing some of his music during that program as well, okay? All right, on the 24th of March, a young woman named Nikki Scully. She's a really cool young lady and someone who I was turned on to through one of the female listeners of the program. So thank you, Iris, for that. And it's going to be a very fun show with Nikki Scully. We'll talk about sacred sites and shamanic adventures around the world with Nikki Scully. All right, Dr. Neil Goldsmith sometime soon. Neil Goldsmith was the managing editor of Omni Magazine. He's also a PhD clinical psychologist, somebody who's worked with psychedelics and a number of other groundbreaking techniques in psychiatry and psychology, and just an all-around interesting fellow. So Dr. Neil Goldsmith sometime in the next month. David Abram. I was hoping to have David in March, but I think it'll probably be April or May. The author of one of the most amazing books I've ever read called Spell of the Sensuous. And it'll be a thrill to have David Abram on the program sometime this spring. Trying to get Roy McAllister to talk about hydrogen and alternative energy. Graham Hancock later this year, for those who've been asking. And lots of others in the wing, okay? All right, so yeah, it should be an interesting spring. We'll do a special for Terrence again in about a month on the anniversary of his passing at the beginning of April. But in between then and summertime, we'll have whole bunch of interesting people on the program, and hopefully some good music too, okay? All right, space weather. What is happening up there in the skies and the stars above our heads? Actually, the sun is still very quiet, interestingly so, and we're always keeping our eyes up there to see what Old Sol might be up to, because you never know when that can change. And as a matter of fact, there was a solar wind stream that sparked some beautiful northern lights over the weekend. The display is sort of tailing off now, but even though the sun has been relatively inactive, there have been reasonably strong solar winds, and people up in the northern latitudes are getting wonderful auroras this time of year. So that's happening up there in the north. Comet 17P Holmes, which we watched throughout the months of October and November and December of last year, this comet that just exploded and increased in brightness by some 1,000,000-fold over the course of about 24 hours in late October. Well, it's still up there, and although it's not quite as bright as it was months ago, it's still a large phenomenon up there in the sky, and it's still visible, essentially, to the naked eye if you've got good night sky viewing. But if you have a decent telescope or some binoculars, you certainly can still see this ghost of a comet, 17P Holmes. It'll be making a rendezvous with the California Nebula in just the next few days. And that's a beautiful area of the night sky, and Comet Holmes will be sort of passing right by there. Anyway, that'll happen on the 7th and 8th of March, and Holmes will pass just sort of offshore of San Francisco in the nebula, if you look at it like that, okay? Okay, what else happening up there? Always our, standard asteroids and comets making their passes through the solar system around the sun, and sometimes reasonably close to our planet. The Earth and Space Conference 2008, the 11th International Conference on Engineering, Science, Construction, and Operations in Challenging Environments. That's in Long Beach, California this week. Here's one, a blast from the past. The conference Go for Lunar Landing, From Terminal Descent to Touchdown. Let's see, Image Information Mining. The Moon Occults Mercury, that happens on the 5th. Moon Occults Venus, the same day on the 5th. Rocket and Balloon Experiments for University Students, that's at Noordwijk in the Netherlands. The 8th Annual Kisatchi Star Party in the Kisatchi National Forest, that's the 5th through the 9th this whole week. Cassini, that probe that's out there cruising around the planet Saturn, is going to make an orbital trim maneuver on the 6th. Let's see, what else we got going on here? Well, daylight savings time, I guess, on the 9th. And you'll have to set your clock ahead an hour, 1 hour. And that's in about 6 days next weekend, okay? All right, so that's a little bit of a peek at what's happening up there in the stars above your head. We do that every week, talk a little bit about the skies and the heavens, and it's always good to keep your gaze upward. There's amazing things happening up there in the stars every night. I was out late last night watching the stars and the moon, just sort of a waning crescent right now, new moon in a couple days, but still very beautiful out last night. And the weather here in mid-Missouri finally warming up a little bit, although today was cold again. But the cold days are getting fewer and fewer and further between. And so I'm very pleased to say that I think, spring is just around the corner. So anyway, last night, an amazing night out in Roachport, Missouri. And, Spring is here. Okay? All right, let's see. What should we do next? Let me play a piece of music for y'all, and we'll come back and talk a little bit more before we do Top of the Hour with Terrence McKenna, True Hallucinations at the midnight hour, okay? All right, it's Mike, and you're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. We are going to hear a song now called Mr. Manifesto. Again, the band is called D Numbers from their CD Light Parade. We'll hear a bunch more from these guys throughout the program tonight. Okay, it's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Good to be with y'all. Thank you. right, everybody. It's Mike back at you here. KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. You listen to Radio Orbit. That's D Numbers. A song called Mr. Manifesto. I like those guys a lot. Okay. The Unity Center of Columbia at 1600 West Broadway is hosting a cinema series entitled Spiritual Masters and Teachers. On March 7th at 7 p.m., they will show Brother Sun, Sister Moon, a film about the life and times of St. Francis of Assisi. More information at 447-0414. He was a nature man, you know, St. Francis. All right, let's see. Also, tune in at 6 p.m. tomorrow. That's Tuesday, for Evening Edition. Will renewable energy start to make serious inroads in the state of Missouri anytime soon? What are the prospects that an initiative petition campaign that Renew Missouri has put together will hasten the switch to clean energy? Join host Mark Heim and his guests as they explore these questions and much more, including how area residents can get involved. Tune in and call in. Mark will be taking your calls, as always, with questions and comments from all perspectives. Don't miss it. Evening Edition, always exciting. Tuesday night, 6 from 7 to p.m., only on your community radio station, KOPN 89.5 FM. Okay, it's Mike, and I'm back with you here. It's about 11:42 or so on the 3rd of March, approaching now the March 4th date of 2008. Always an interesting day, March 4th, because it resonates, well, with me at least, because of the story. This amazing adventure that happened in 1971 to a couple of people that somehow, in the weird way of the world, crossed my paths years ago. Anyway, we'll hear a little bit about that story, the experiment at La Chirera, Terrence and Dennis McKenna, as related by Terrence in a audio presentation called True Hallucinations. And we'll hear that in just about 15 minutes or so, okay? All right. Bye, Angela. I love you. Let's see. Before then, I've got a couple of notable folks I'd like to mention and say hello and goodbye to. Luther Burbank had a birthday which would be approaching us on March 7th. Luther Burbank was born March 7th, 1849. He was an American botanist and horticulturist, and an absolute pioneer and magician, essentially, in agricultural science. He developed all kinds of different strains and varieties of plants over his career, and these included different kinds of fruits and flowers and grains and vegetables and cacti. And he was probably most famous for the russet potato, the Burbank russet potato, which he developed and became the world's predominant processing potato. Anyway, Luther Burbank was sort of like a, he was a shaman of sorts. See, he was working in the 1800s, before the days of genetic engineering and all this sort of stuff. And he was very successful in creating actual, you know, new species of plants. And nobody knew how he did this. This is why he was so successful. He was considered just like a celebrity, you know, around the world because of what he was able to do with plants. And I spoke with Stephen Herod Buhner. I forget which interview it was Stephen, but in one of the shows that we did, Stephen talks a little bit about Luther Burbank and what a remarkable person he really was, and the fact that he essentially used some sort of communication with the plants in order to get them to grow in a different fashion and to evolve or devolve to his particular specifications. He was able to sort of just talk to them and get them to do what he wanted. And, of course, nobody understood it. And to this day, you know, if you're in one of those fields, if you're in botany or horticulture or something like that, lots of people will know the name Luther Burbank, but very few people will talk about what he did and how he did it because they just don't know. They just don't get it. I should talk to Stephen a little bit more about that someday. Luther Burbank, very interesting person. So anyway, happy birthday, March 7th, to Luther Burbank. And he actually passed away in April of 1926, but he was quite an interesting fellow back there in the late 19th century. Okay? All right. One other wonderful person of note who I'd like to mention, my grandfather, Kanji Sapa, Sylvester Black Crow. He was a leader of the Oglala Lakota people. He passed away on the 5th of March, 2004. And he was an amazing person, an amazing teacher, a magician, and a shaman, and a medicine man. Grew up under the guidance of Nicholas Black Elk and was close friends with my great teacher and great friend, Grandfather Wallace Black Elk, Wambly Chikala. Grandfather Black Crow, along with Leonard Crow Dog and six other men, brought the Lakota Sun Dance back out of hiding and returned it to the Lakota people in 1968. It was a pretty daring stand against federal laws that at the time were forbidding Native American people to practice their religious rituals and ceremonies. Until his death in March of 2004, Black Crow Sundance was held every year since 1968 on his family land near Wambly, South Dakota, on Pine Ridge, on the Pine Ridge Reservation. Anyway, Kanji Sapa, he was an amazing, amazing person, wonderful teacher, and someone who I was so fortunate to be able to spend time with during the period from, late 1999, I guess, until 2002, and then he passed in the very early spring of 2004. But during the time that he was here and the short period that I had the opportunity to get to know him and learn from him, you know, it was amazing time well spent, and I continue to learn from him today. So, Kanji Sapa, Pila Mayaya Mitunkashila. All right, talked about Luther Burbank, talked about the grandfathers. All right, I think that I'm going to play a piece of music here. Let's see. And then we'll come back and we'll do True Hallucinations with Terrence McKenna, all right? All right, everybody, it's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. This is Calusifixion, another song from D Numbers from their CD Light Parade. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Thank you. D Numbers. Once again, that one was called Crucifixion. It's Mike. You're listening to it on Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Just about 5 minutes before the midnight hour on the 3rd of March, 2008. A couple quick things here in the news that I wanted to mention since we got a couple minutes before the top of the hour. Here's a story from Japan about Planet X, perhaps? I don't know. Check this out. Japanese scientists eye new planet. Tokyo, AFP. Scientists at a Japanese university said Thursday they believed another planet up to two-thirds the size of the Earth was orbiting in the far reaches of the solar system. The researchers at Kobe University in western Japan said calculations using computer simulations led them to conclude it was only a matter of time before the mysterious Planet X was found. Because of the very cold temperature, its surface would be covered with ice, la la la, okay, all right, that's speculation. The possibility is high that a yet unknown planet-class celestial body measuring 30% to 70% of the Earth's mass exists in the outer edges of the solar system. If research is conducted on a wide scale, the planet is likely to be discovered in less than 10 years, it said. Anyway, interesting story that sort of ties in with some of these old myths that people have been talking about for so long, planets that have long orbital trajectories that take them thousands of years to circle the sun. Anyway, here's the some Japanese scientists that say that's actually the case. Let's see, another story here that I wanted to mention with regard to DNA. This is a story that is entitled DNA Found to Have Impossible Telepathic Properties. DNA has been found to have a bizarre ability to put itself together, even at a distance, when according to known science, it shouldn't be able to. Explanation? None, at least not yet. Scientists are reporting evidence that, contrary to our current beliefs about what is possible, intact double-stranded DNA has the amazing ability to recognize similarities in other DNA strands from a distance. Somehow, they are able to identify one another, and the tiny bits of genetic material tend to congregate with similar DNA. The recognition of similar sequences in DNA's chemical subunits occurs in a way unrecognized by science. There is no known reason why the DNA is able to combine the way it does, and from a current theoretical standpoint, this feat should be chemically impossible. Even so, the research published in the ACS Journal of Physical Chemistry B shows very clearly that homology recognition between sequences of several hundred nucleotides occurs without physical contact or presence of proteins. Double helixes of DNA can recognize matching molecules from a distance and then gather together, all seemingly without help from any other molecules or chemical signals. In the study, scientists observed the behavior of fluorescently tagged DNA strands placed in water that contain no proteins or other material that could interfere with the experiment. Strands with identical nucleotide sequences were about twice as likely to gather together as DNA strands with different sequences. No one knows how individual DNA strands could possibly be communicating in this way, yet somehow they do. The telepathic effect is a source of wonder and amazement for scientists. So, a very, very interesting story there, again, with regard to DNA and how it functions. It is essentially magic, and it is what operates all of our bodies and all of the biological life forms on this planet. But, you know, it's not just biology. Once you understand DNA, you can make anything. Soda cans, telephones, microphones in radio studios, you know, along with biology. The secrets of DNA are the secrets to all of matter. And it's a very amazing concept and something that we're getting very close to understanding, perhaps. Again, it's one of these, you know, razor's edge scenarios that are accumulating more and more every day. You know, how will it be used? How will it be implemented if we achieve the capability to fully manipulate and implement DNA strategies, you know, where we can actually do what we want with it? Anyway, amazing stuff on the horizon for sure. And certainly it's amazing things on the horizon in 1971 in the jungles of Central America, a place called La Chorrera, where a remarkable series of events happened that ever since I found out about them, I have been convinced that something very important, unique, special, novel, evolutionary, revolutionary took place during that time period. And I've been fortunate to know the two men that were involved as the primary characters in this particular play, Terrence and Dennis McKenna, two amazing people who have had a tremendous impact in my own life and my own path, and a story of those two brothers. You know, it's sort of like the hero twin story, by the way. I sort of thought that today, that it's very similar to many of the mythological tales of, you know, what we talk about in those circles as the hero twins. And you can find examples of that in many different traditions, including the Maya. At any rate, the story is told here, in part at least, by Terrence. It's called True Hallucinations, and I hope you all enjoy it, okay? It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. We'll do this straight through for about an hour, and then come back and talk with you all a little bit more, okay? Once again, Terrence McKenna, True Hallucinations. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like to welcome you to the Phoenix Bookstore. Terrence McKenna's here tonight, and we do have copies of many of his different books here, and if you want to purchase them after the talk, you can bring it up and have him sign it. Also, there will be audio recordings of this talk available very shortly after it's done. This afternoon, I got a phone call from a friend who said, "Turn on KFI right now on Daryl Gates. Terrence McKenna's on here." With Daryl Gates, the guy who wants to shoot pot smokers in the back. And he did an excellent job, I must say. I did call my dad and make sure he was listening too. Anyway, I think all of you know who he is, so I'm just going to turn this over to him. Terrence McKenna.
Can everybody hear? Good. Well, it's great to be here. It's always fun to come to the West Side and see the usual suspects all assembled. I'm here to flog a new book. It seems like they're coming out about once a year, and that will continue on into next year. The object of attention at the moment is True Hallucinations, and I'm very up for this because my other books were basically speculation, philosophy, ideas, art historical comment on psychedelics, so forth and so on. This is autobiography, narrative. It has action, heartbreak, erotic outrage, climax, denouement, all those good literary type things. And I wrote it basically because a lot of people have said it seemed to them incomprehensible how my brother and I got to where we are in terms of the way in which we've furnished our heads. And this is basically the story of the formative 2 weeks in our lives. In 1971, I was 23, my brother was 19. I'd spent several years in Asia already, having been run out of Berkeley because of the revolution. And we were graduates of the LSD revolution, but it had left us wanting more, specifically wanting the kinds of experiences that the classical commentators on psychedelics described. And by that I mean people like Havelock Ellis in The Dance of Life, or S. Weir Mitchell, who wrote about mescaline. LSD for us never delivered visions. It delivered insight and feelings and complex thoughts, but not visions, not activity in the visual cortex that these classical commentators had led us to expect. And I had been in India for a number of years and pretty well managed to convince myself that whatever spirituality had ever been there, it had evaporated thousands of years ago, and that what we were left with was a very grasping and mendacious priestly hierarchy that was about as cynical as religion gets. And I was raised Catholic, so I know what I'm talking about. So then we decided, well, where the gnosis must be is in the Amazon, where we knew there was a pristine Aboriginal shamanism based on hallucinogens. And I stress our youth, because I think people imagine that you can only make contributions if you're old and laden with degrees and that sort of thing. And basically, our pure, reckless inventiveness carried us further into the heart of the mystery than I would ever have believed possible. And I should say a little bit about the method, because I think it's important. Rationalism in confrontation with the weird edges is what's always worked for me. In other words, if you're a true believer, if you have some prepackaged philosophy, then you're going to miss a great deal, because you're pre-programmed to ignore what doesn't fit into your model. And it doesn't matter what your model is. But if you are simply the open-minded skeptic slash witness, and then if you push at the edges of the phenomenal world, you know, go to the highest mountains, the oldest cities, the deepest deserts, the most remote jungles, and just simply put yourself in these circumstances, the cosmic giggle can get at you. You know, it can't get at you if you're pursuing your job delivering messages for Matthew and Son or whatever it is you've got going. But if you will tear the human atom of your individuality out of the collectivity and set yourself into a wilderness, a desert, an uninhabited island, then this thing can rise out of the depths and communicate if it chooses, shape your life for sure, blow your mind. And there's almost a kind of unconsciousness, which is the precondition for success in this area. When you are superbly educated and completely alert to all possibilities and scanning the horizon for action, this is the equivalent of watching a pot to wait for it to boil. It won't happen. It's when you become preoccupied, broke, a touch of dysentery, a little confusion in the mix, and then it can sink its teeth into you. So I thought Harper, who published this, and I think did a beautiful job with the production of it, has informed me that I, by joining up with them, I'm no more the cheerful, extemporaneous ad lib artist of the past, that I have been elevated into the high and holy realm of being a litterateur. And what that means is you have to read. And it's not really my métier, but it pleases them no end back where they cut the checks. So I will, in fact, read to you from my new book. And I should say a bit about our goal. you can't just willy-nilly head off to sit in the desert. You have to have an agenda, however flimsy and based on misinformation. The agenda tells you what you're supposed to do next. So our agenda was, we had been interested, as I'm sure many of you have been and are, in the psychedelic flash that accompanies DMT, which is extraordinarily brief. It's like a minute and a half, 2 minutes tops. And we had the notion that if you could get in there for a half an hour, you might be able to bring back something really astonishing for the rest of the gang to puzzle over. Of course, you might leave your mind behind in the process, but, you know, nothing is for sure, right? So it turned out that Richard Evans Schultes, the great doyen of psychedelic botany, had reported a few years ago a psychedelic plant complex called Ukupe, which was used by a dwindling tribe of Indians called Witoto. And it was orally active. It was a little pill that they made out of the resin of a tree. And the literature insisted that they used this Ukupe to speak with little men. Well, you can imagine the effect that had on us. I mean, after all, speaking with little men is something that's very dear to our hearts, hardly to speak of speaking with little women. So we set off for the Amazon to contact this Indian tribe, to try and see if we couldn't persuade them to reveal how they made this stuff, or at least to score from them if all else failed. And what this meant then, in practical terms, was going to a place called La Chorrera. You like that. Chorro is a funny word in Spanish. It's not exactly a waterfall. It's not that steep. It's where a river goes at about a 45 or steeper. Colloquially, it refers to the angle of the dangle on male liquid evacuation, I think the proper way to put it. So a chorro is a stream at a 45-degree angle that's moving very rapidly. And this place, La Chorrera, about which we knew practically nothing except these Indians were there, turned out not to be your ordinary anonymous jungle mission out there in the big green. It turned out this place had a hellacious history attached to it, because it was the place from which the Putumayo rubber boom was administered. Not very many people know or recall that before Waco, before Tel Zaatar, before Auschwitz, before Guernica, before Armenia, before these great episodes and spasms of extinction in the 20th century, it was all rehearsed between 1912 and 17 in the Peruvian Amazon, when British banks bankrolled essentially Peruvian mafias to wage a war of terror on these Indians. And the issue was rubber for the World War. This was before synthetic rubber had been invented. And these Indians were told, you bring in X number of kilos of rubber per month, and whatever you fall below your quota, that weight in your own flesh will be removed by machete. And these Indians went from 45,000 to 3,500 by the time we got there. So in spite of this beautiful climaxed rainforest, and you know, we were actually moving through a landscape of ghosts and catastrophe. And when you would walk these jungle trails in the afternoon with the sunlight slanting in, you would swear you could hear the footfalls of manacled feet and low voices conversing. I mean, it was a very strange place. So, here's a picture of it. Most of the Amazon basin is made up of alluvial deposits from the Andes. La Chorrera is different. A river, the Igarapaná, flows and into a crack. It becomes very rapid, then drops over an edge, a lip, creating not exactly a waterfall, but a narrow channel of water, a flume whose violent outpouring has made a sizable lake. La Chorrera is a paradisical place. You push very hard and suddenly you are there. There are no stinging or biting insects. In the evening, mist drifts across a large pasture, creating a beautiful pastoral scene. There is the mission, the foam-flecked lake below, the jungle surrounding, and much to my surprise, white cattle. The afternoon following our arrival, at the edge of the pasture, which had been cleared by the Spanish priests who had managed Mission La Chorrera since its establishment in the 20s, I held and turned over in my hand perfect specimens of the same species of mushroom I had eaten near Florencia just a week or two before. In the pasture before me were dozens of these mushrooms. After examining several, my brother concurred, pronounced them the same Stropharia cubensis we had found before, one of the largest, strongest, and certainly most widely distributed of any of the known psilocybin mushrooms. What to do? We had no data on the proper dosage of psilocybin. Our expedition's thinned-down drug and plant file was concerned with flowering plants, not fungi. Collectively, we seem to remember that in the Oaxacan mushroom ritual described by Gordon Wasson, mushrooms were always eaten in pairs, with several pairs consumed. We determined to eat 6 mushrooms each that same evening. And then here is my journal entry for this day, February 23rd, 1971. Are we indeed now in some way camped on the edge of another dimension? Yesterday afternoon, Dave discovered Stropharia cubensis in the damp pastures behind the house where we had hung our hammocks. He and I gathered 30 delicious psilocybin-saturated specimens in about half an hour. We each ate 6 and spent last night on an enormously rich and alive, yet gentle and elusive trip. In between strange lights in the pasture and discussion of our project, I am left with the sense that by penetrating the local psychedelic flora this way, we have taken a giant step toward deeper understanding. Multifaceted and benevolent, as complex as mescaline, as intense as LSD, the mushroom, as is said at peyote, teaches the right way to live. This particular mushroom species is unclaimed, so far as I know, by any aboriginal people anywhere, and thus is neutral ground in the tryptamine dimension we are exploring. Through this unclaimed vegetable teacher, one can gain entry into the world of the elf chemists. The experience of the mushroom is subtle, but can reach out to the depth and breadth of a truly intense psychedelic experience. It is, however, extremely mercurial and difficult to catch at work. Dennis and I, through a staggered description of our visions, noticed a similarity of content that seemed to suggest a telepathic phenomenon or some sort of simultaneous perception of the same invisible landscape. A tight headache accompanied the experience in its final stages, but this was quick to fade, and the body strain and exhaustion often met with in unextracted vegetable drugs was not present. The mushroom is a transdimensional doorway which sly fairies have left slightly ajar for anyone to enter into who can find the key and who wishes to use this power, the power of vision, to explore this peculiar and naturally occurring psychoactive complex. We are closing distance with the most profound event a planetary ecology can encounter, the emergence of life from the dark chrysalis of matter. That was after one trip, you know. I got it, and the lock began to tighten. And So then much of the rest of the story, with a few flashbacks and some philosophical musing on the content, deals with a series of ideas which Dennis began to develop based around the question, do you know what we could do with this stuff? And then he proceeded to answer his own question. And he had an idea, which I do confess I find rather hard to put out in 10 minutes and feel that I've done an adequate job. That's what the book is for. I think in the 10-minute version, it sounds fascinating but preposterous. In the book, I think we make it fascinating and entirely credible. And the concept was he seemed to have gotten a very deep connection into this logos-like gnosis-conveying force in the mushroom, and it began talking about how you could use this thing to essentially give birth to your own soul as a physical object. You know, we all have a mind or a soul, but it's an invisible organ. It isn't like your left hand or your nose. We never see it, and we don't know whether it's in the brain or it surrounds the body, but it's very real to us. We think with it. So he was suggesting that there is a way to, and some of you have heard me say this in the past, that we need to turn the body inside out, make the soul visible, make the body something commanded in the imagination. Well, he took this as a set of engineering specs and set to work to figure out how to do it. And the method is given in here. I had to arm wrestle Harper fairly strenuously because they said, you know, these notes of your brothers, I mean, they're overstated, scientifically specious, riddled with the incomprehensible, so forth and so on. Said, yes, but it worked. And driven by the thought that there may be someone who will read this book who is far smarter than Dennis or I, then all the details must be here. If you want to read it as an adventure story, that's fine. You just skip over Dennis's notebook entries. But if you see it as a recipe book, then that's where you want to place your attention. So he became very highly agitated and irascible and just obsessed by this idea of this experiment to condense the mind, give birth to the soul, emanatize the eschaton, call down the flying saucers, fuse spirit with matter, create the universal panacea at the end of time, and lead a triumphant humanity into hyperspace, or something like that. And my attitude was, hell, there's no swerving him from this. He can talk of nothing else. So let's just cut to the chase and do the damn experiment. And surely nothing will happen. And then we can, you know, he can make of that what he wishes. And the rest of us will go back to botanizing, trying to get tight with these Indians and push forward this program to get this DMT. Thing, because essentially the presence of these mushrooms has totally overturned our original agenda. Well, then he performed the experiment, and to the point that he performed the experiment, I had been what I thought of as the indulgent, fair-minded witness. He performed the experiment, and promptly went bananas. He had said before that he might experience what he called a psychic reversal, but I had just, you know, he'd said a lot of things going into this, and I hadn't weighed it that heavily. Within minutes of finishing this experiment, it became clear that not only was he highly agitated and raving constantly, but he also didn't seem to be able to hear other people. He talked right through people. And when you would point out to him that this was an incredibly rude thing to do, then there would just be a huge amount of confusion and apologizing, and he seemed genuinely not to be able to hear other people and was raving constantly. Meanwhile, at the moment the experiment was performed, I, who had to this point just been sort of playing along, it was as though he reached into my deepest plumbing and he just threw a switch, and this channel opened and it began to inform me. It was not like any drug I've ever taken. It was not like any experience I'd ever had. There was no hallucination. What there was what I would describe as pure understanding. Understanding that amplified itself every hour, every minute. I mean, I had only to take a cup and dip up a glass of water from the spring and pour it past my eyes, and I could say, I understand water. Or pick up a leaf and look at it and have some kind of huge, wordless, but very emotionally deep understanding of the ecosystem, the jungle, the connections to the planet. I mean, it seemed to me that I was very close to what looked like enlightenment of some sort. I mean, just an ability to be absolutely at peace, fully in the moment, and just everything became a teacher. Everything was able to communicate to me its essence. But what was bringing me down in this situation was that Dennis's condition was creating a huge wave of accusation and confusion in our small expedition. Some people thought he should be airlifted to a hospital. Other people thought we should simply wait for him to ascend into heaven. And it's hard to reconcile that kind of thing, you know. And many, many strange things went on, and I'll give you a flavor of our psychology at this time. The day after the experiment, or the evening following the experiment was done sometime around dawn in the early morning hours of March 5th, 1971. The evening of March 5th, we all hung our hammocks together in this hut, and I got up in the middle of the night to take a leak because of the condensed milk that you have to drink when you're an explorer. And I checked everybody out, and everybody seemed to be sleeping soundly, and then I lay in my hammock a long, long time, and everything seemed peaceful and still. But as breakfast unfolded the following morning, the 6th of March, the morning after this, it became clear that the restful sleep I had imagined we had all shared had been anything but that. From Dennis, still disorganized but expansive, comments emerged that he had, or imagined he had, a very active night. Upon close questioning, it came out that he was completely convinced that sometime during the night, he had arisen and dressed, and then in a series of nocturnal adventures, and then had a series of nocturnal adventures. These involved going alone in the darkness to the thundering immensity of the Choro over a mile away, then returning to climb and spend some time in a large tree near the edge of the mission, then making his way back across the pasture and returning to his hammock strung among all the others. The thought of him wandering around during the night on those trails without his glasses, which he had thrown away in the first minutes after the experiment. He announced that they were no longer necessary and had just flung them away. He also had thrown away all of his clothes and methodically smashed everybody's watch. Without his glasses, falling in and out of shamanic ecstasy, perhaps howling and otherwise paleolithically comporting himself, was too much for me. It was a breach of the collective cool, even though I was 90% certain that it had never really happened, I was determined to eliminate all possibility of such rambles in the future. Dennis's story was the classic description of a shamanic night journey. He said that he had gone to the Choro and had meditated in the mission cemetery we had visited before. He had begun to return to the camp when he confronted a particularly large Enga tree near where the path skirted the edge of the mission. On impulse, he had climbed it, aware as he did that the ascent of the world tree is the central motif of the Siberian shamanic journey. As he climbed the tree, he felt the flickering polarities of many archetypes, and as he reached the highest point in his ascent, something that he called the vortex opened ahead of him, a swirling, enormous doorway into time. He could see the cyclopean megaliths of Stonehenge, and beyond them, revolving at a different speed and at a higher plane, the outlines of the pyramids, gleaming and marble-faceted as they have not been since the days of pharaonic Egypt. And yet further into the turbulent maw of the vortex, he saw mysteries that were ancient long before the advent of man, titanic archetypal forms on worlds unimagined by us, the arcane machineries of sentient agencies that swept through this part of the galaxy when our planet was young and its surface barely cooled. This machinery, these gibbering abysses touched with the cold of interstellar space and aeon-consuming time, rushed down upon him. He fainted, and time, who can say how much, passed him by. So this is the kind of stuff we were dealing with. And my point in writing the book, I mean, there are many stories of people going bananas, and then there are many stories where there's a very radical break with reality, and you either have to believe it or not believe it. And I'm thinking of Carlos Castaneda, Whitley Strieber. I mean, after all, proctological examinations carried out in your bedroom by gray-faced aliens from another world, that's a pretty radical break with my reality. But here it rides the edge, because this is a true story. It is, to the best of my ability, unembellished. But it argues that guys like Strieber and Castaneda actually do have their finger on something. It is rare to violate the laws of physics and, you know, universal expectation based on experience, but it's not impossible. It happened to us. There were several things that can be isolated out of our story that simply secure answers to certain questions that people have asked since time immemorial. For example, we had telepathic experiences that absolutely satisfy me that under some conditions, one person can not only penetrate another person's thought, but what he did was much more spectacular than that. He penetrated into my memory. He was able to talk about things that had happened to me that I had never told him about and that I was not consciously thinking about. So it was as though somehow our minds had become fused. There were numerous other things. Unfortunately, there isn't time to get into all of this. But the point is, and I started out by saying this, rationalism and the investigation of the unusual with a fair and open mind is the working prescription for securing for yourself that the world is stranger than we can suppose, and certainly stranger than science can suppose, certainly stranger than the cultural myths that we are living under dare to suppose. And I don't know where all this goes, you know, because this story happened to real people, every single one of whom is still alive as we speak. There was no happily ever after, except in the sense that the Logos promised that the point of view, I guess is the way to put it, would spread, would become generalized. And when I recall that in 1971 I was penniless, wanted by Interpol, careerless, and, you know, pretty much the Amazon was the end of the line for me. I spent all my money going in to La Charrera. I did not have a clue. I was at the end of my rope. And now this strange meme based on psilocybin, elf machines in hyperspace, the collapse of the vectors of history in 2012, the whisperings from the transmundane other, this whole thing that we've released seems to be sustaining itself, basically because of people like you, because somehow we're all part of this story. I really believe that this is about a discovery of some sort, so huge that we can't even put a name to it. I mean, Columbus could say, "I found land," and Galileo could say, "There are mountains on the moon." Is it then for me to say there are elves inside our head, our collective head, and that somehow this is going to have an impact? I'm convinced of it, that it is for a purpose, that the entire ecology of the planet is attempting to communicate ever more exotic messages to us as the culture crisis deepens. And it's too much for one person or one small group of people to try to come to terms with. It has to be laid before the bar of public opinion, and people have to deal with this in the context of their own psychedelic experiences and their own hopes and fears. And perhaps, you know, if this is done and we can reach a consensus, then we may well discover that the hallucinations that have prompted us into religion and art and music and mathematics over millennia of time actually were true hallucinations all the time. Well, that's all I have to say about that. I'll answer some questions, and I understand you're going to read them?
Yep.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Somehow I think you wrote this one.
I wrote it?
No. It sounds like something you would write. Is the TV computer satellite that surrounds the whole planet have a collective psychedelic effect on the world population? Are psychedelics a mirror of this, or an antidote, or an anesthetic to the environment?
Why do you think I would ask a question?
I don't know. Well, with the wording, I guess.
I don't know. I mean, in a sense, it seems to me that what's happening is in our minds and outside our minds, if there is an outside our minds, but in the three-dimensional space of culture, we're undergoing an informational revolution of some sort. All data is rising to the surface. 9 million computers a month are being connected into networks worldwide at the very moment that some unknown number of people, because we can't get data on this, are taking psychedelics per month. And clearly, the thing that is unique about us as a species is that we have made much of information. You know, ants have scripted it down into a few pheromonal signals. Coyote packs have a kind of a pre-language. You can make what you wish of the dolphins and the whales. But no species has ever grabbed on to information the way we have. And I believe that history is a self-limiting process, that we are coming to the end of it, that business as usual has been taken off the menu, and that if you take all these curves, the curve of petroleum extraction, the curve of the spread of epidemic diseases, the curve of the dissolution of the ozone hole, the curve of the rise of global population. If you plot all these curves together, you reach the conclusion that sometime in the second decade of the next century, the contradictions become so excruciating that the entire thing is going to be forced into some kind of phase transition. It may be extinction, it may be a planetary Bosnia, or it could be something positive. But business as usual is off the menu. And the psychedelics connect you up to this looming event, because we are now, having journeyed toward it for at least 10,000 years, we're less than 20 years away from it. So it is imminent in every sense of the word. And to contact it, all you have to do is close your eyes, smoke a bomber, eat a mushroom, sit in yoga for a moment. I mean, it is very, very near. The energy threshold between us and the transcendental object is very, very thin. And that's why things are so peculiar, because the architecture of our collective lives and the architecture of our individual lives have fallen under the domain of a kind of attractor. And this is the attractor which, when it penetrated into our primate ancestors, it drew out of a higher animal ourselves. We are literally being sculpted on a scale of a million years. An animal species, some kind of advanced monkey, is being turned into the carrier for a projection from the transmundane that leaves us with one foot in the primate world and one foot firmly planted in the angelic world. We are a species in the process of being alchemically transformed by the other. And we can't know what that means for ourselves, for the fate of the planet. It is an absolute mystery. It is the mystery of our own becoming. I don't know if that was the answer to the question, but...
The Supreme Court...
Picky.
The Supreme Court has ruled against the Native American Church use of peyote. How will this impact other people's use of the sacrament?
Well, not at all, I hope.
Yeah.
Progress of human civilization in the area of defining human freedom is not made from the top down. No king, no government, no parliament ever extended to the people more rights than the people insisted upon. And I think we've come to a place with this psychedelic thing, and we have the gay community as a model, and all the other communities, the ethnic communities. We simply have to say, look, LSD has been around for 50 years now. We just celebrated the birthday. It ain't going away. We are not going away. We are not slack-jawed, dazed, glazed, unemployable, psychotic creeps. We are pillars of society. You can't run your computers, your fashion houses, your publishing houses, your damn magazines. You can't do anything in culture without psychedelic people in key positions. And this is the great unspoken truth of American creativity. And so I think it's time basically to come out of the closet and just say, you know, I'm stoned and I'm proud. So, if that's a problem for you, you got a problem, fella.
Talk about hemp and its possibilities for our future.
Hemp, yes. Well, this is interesting. And you all know the basic pitch for hemp, and I wouldn't be what I am if it weren't for cannabis. I think, and I want to see it legalized, although I'm very, very skeptical. I don't think the people who want it legalized have fairly confronted what it really is. The argument is twofold, as I understand it, for legalizing hemp. Is number one, a lot of money could be made off all these wonderful cloths and products and lubricants and so and medicines and so forth. And the other argument relates to its psychoactivity. And the argument made there is, it's no big deal. It's no big deal. Well, I actually think it is somewhat of a big deal. And I think the people who don't want to see it legalized see it that way. Cultures are shaped by the drugs that they take and that they suppress. We are a sugar, red meat, and alcohol culture primarily, with tobacco and alcohol to shore all that up. To think for a minute about a drug like coffee, caffeine. Every labor contract in Western civilization contains a clause which secures the worker's right to halt the assembly line twice a day to fuel up on a drug known to cause liver damage and all kinds of problems. Well, now, why isn't there a cannabis break? The reason is that caffeine perfectly fits in to a program that would have you busily screwing widgets onto wonkets and moving them along the assembly line. In other words, it promotes capitalist values, performing repetitious tasks in a state of sort of glazed acceptance. Cannabis, on the other hand, what is always said about it? Makes you inefficient. Lazy, uninterested in earning your Mercedes and your house.
Fighting a war.
Yeah. So I think that if we could, I'm very interested in this cannabis thing. I think it may be the wedge through which we can push the whole psychedelic agenda. But I guarantee you, if it's legalized, it will be a tremendous big deal because cannabis promotes feminist values, anti-capitalist values, values that promote introspection rather than manic social values of the sort that you see alcohol promoting. It would make an immense change in the architecture of the culture.
Who deciphered the Voynich manuscript?
For $25,000? for those of you who don't know what the question is about, it refers to a very interesting manuscript that I've written about that is an unread or unreadable book. It's written in an unknown language. No other example of this language has ever been found. And the CIA spent a lot of time trying to decipher this book because it's at least 500 years old, and it drove them bonkers to believe that modern code-cracking machinery could not deal with a medieval manuscript. I mean, modern code-making is orders of magnitude more sophisticated than anything that the 14th or 15th century possessed. So they spent a lot of money trying to understand this code and essentially failed. Now, very recently, a gentleman on the East Coast named Dr. Leo Levitov, and this is the answer to the question, Leo Levitov, wrote a book called The Solution to the Voynich Manuscript. And he has, he believes, figured out what it is. And the reason the CIA couldn't decipher it, according to Levitov, is because it was never encrypted in the first place. He says it isn't an encrypted manuscript. It's an artificial alphabet being used to write down a rural form of polyglot medieval Flemish with a huge number of Old French and Old High German loan words. So there you have it, folks.
Do you know if Illinois bunchweed, is it bunchweed or bundleweed? I think it's bundleweed.
Bundleweed. Mm-hmm.
Is available from any commercial nursery?
I believe it's available from Of the Jungle in Sebastopol, California. I'm not their sales rep, so I don't keep weekly track on their inventory, but I believe it's available from Of the Jungle.
Call information.
Yeah.
What future modifications to the TimeWave software are ideally in store?
Oh, what a great question. Well, the TimeWave software is being put out both in an MS-DOS version and a Mac version, and they're both pretty flashy, and in a sense that finishes the program of bringing to the public the TimeWave in its raw and sort of naked form. What we're moving on to now is sort of a game, which would be a time travel simulator. It would be created in an immersive technology. This phrase, immersive technology, now replaces previous buzzwords, virtual reality. Dump that. Only outsiders call it that now. It's called immersive technology. And the idea is to build in a CD-ROM environment, a huge visual database to accompany the TimeWave, and then the TimeWave could easily be configured into a game where in a certain historical period, if you encountered some difficulty and you mastered it, you would be catapulted forward one resonance. And the idea would be to move from the Big Bang to the transcendental object at the end of time and beat out the competition. And it's a very sly way. I mean, I'm not big on products or games, but it's a very sly way of teaching people history. And you could make so many paths through the data that the game would never play the same way twice, or it would take thousands of times to do that. And a lot of talent seems to have come forward for this, so that looms.
What happened to your theory about change versus non-change and the cataclysmic events to come? Did that become the time wave continuum?
Yeah, that's right. I referred to this a little earlier when I was talking about how business as usual is off the menu and all these curves are converging. I really believe that the core insight for me of the psychedelic experience, and I believe that it is objectively real, is the discovery that history is a finite phenomenon of some sort. It began 8,000 years ago, and it will end at some point in the future. Well, that's not terribly upsetting or challenging unless one specifies at what point in the future. And I maintain, for reasons most of which are too complicated to go into here, that it is about 20 years in the future, that the planet can no longer sustain us. We can no longer create any kind of existence that we could consider humane, and that technology, population, the way in which psychedelics are stimulating the imagination, the way in which culture generally is driving the imagination, that we are on the brink of being able to design ourselves and place ourselves into a new world of some sort. And I'm vague on the details. It's not outer space. It's not, some kind of a managed Orwellian collectivist paradise. It's something more profound than that. We are perhaps going to download ourselves into a gold ytterbium cube that we will super cool and bury 1,000 feet beneath Copernicus, and there all walk on the virtual beaches barefoot and alive. I don't know. But what is happening here at the end of the 20th century, you see, is a kind of birth process. Think of the fetal life in the womb. You're endlessly adrift in the amniotic ocean. weightless. Food and oxygen are being delivered without even your awareness through the umbilical cord. It is paradise. And if you were there and you were in control of your fate, you would choose to prolong it forever. But what happens instead is that you get squeezed into the birth canal. Then the paradise turns into hell, strangulation, pressure. You are literally being squeezed to death. To ask the fetus at that point to conceive of the wonderful, satisfying life that it is going to have 40 years hence as a stockbroker living in Bel Air and collecting minor works of Cubist art is ridiculous. Because, you know, that's not where we're at the moment. And so I believe that culturally we are in the birth canal and everything appears to be being destroyed. The oceans, the atmosphere, the very integrity of our own bodies because of all these diseases, ideological contamination, you name it. But we simply must push forward. It's a forward escape. We can never go back, you know, to the game-dotted plains of archaic Africa. That's gone. It's all gone. The only way out is forward. It's called a forward escape. And I'm interested in propagating this notion because, number one, I believe it, and number two, it is a message of hope without which I think people are going to be very challenged because things are going to get worse, apparently much worse. I mean, it would not cause me to break stride if the mess in Bosnia spread until it stretched from the Arctic Circle to Turkey and from Vienna to Vladivostok. I mean, those people are setting themselves up for hell on earth, and we will be dragged into it in some fashion, even if we only have to witness it. So history is turning into a white-knuckle ride, for sure. And without the faith in some kind of transcendental phase transition, I think there's a tendency to despair and to panic and to nihilism. And religion has failed. You know, what religion gives us is what we saw last week in Texas. They can only conceive of phase transition as apocalypse, as Ragnarok, the twilight of the gods. That isn't what it is. We are closing distance with the first moments of true human civilization, you know, when people actually do treat each other with respect, when there actually is a place made for the celebration of human differences, when we actually do feel the suffering of the people around us and respond to that. So without psychedelics and the models that they make possible, hope is, I think, a very, very fragile thing. And that's why I take the position that I do, because I think that we are on the brink of the adventure for which we left the trees and left the African plain. But it's not a sure thing. It rests in our hands, as it always has. I mean, remember that in the last million years, 9 times... the ice has moved south from the poles, miles high, pushing before it our ancestors, people wrapped in skin, naked as jaybirds, marginal as can be, no antibiotics, no global weather forecasting, no nothing. And they didn't drop the ball. They survived. They took care of their children and their elderly. They passed the skills and the technologies and the insights and the songs down the long stream of time. Can we do any less? We who have in our hands the power to shape the planet for good or evil, we who can communicate with each other globally in a moment, it would be a pretty sad commentary on the notion of cultural progress and intelligence if they could keep the faith and we can't. So it all went for this. It will all be made clear in the lifetime of most of us. And so I just want to sort of close on that note, invite you to keep the faith, invite you to explore the edges, and to make of yourself a vessel, a conduit for the world-transforming logos that is trying to speak to all of us to create a sane and viable and celebratory world for our children and their children. Thank you very much.
KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My name is Mike Hagan, and you're listening to Radio Orbit. It is about 1 a.m., plus or minus about 30 seconds. Hope you enjoyed that wonderful piece of historical audio, I think from 1992 or so. Terrence McKenna from the Phoenix Bookstore in Los Angeles, talking about his experiences in the jungles of Colombia with his brother at La Chorrera in 1971, and touching on a whole bunch of other things there too as well. All right, it's me and you, and I'll be back with you in just a few minutes. This is D Numbers. Check it out. This one's called Here. It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia. the numbers. Again, from their CD called Light Parade. That was called Here. And that's where I am, and that's where you are. And it's a pleasure to be here with you. It's Mike Hagan. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM, about 7 minutes after the hour of 1 a.m. now on the 4th of March, 2008. 37 years ago tonight, the experiment at La Chorrera that you just heard about over the last hour or so. An amazing, amazing adventure. And as I mentioned before the presentation, something that in the core of my being, although I don't understand or claim to understand exactly what or why, whatever did happen there at La Chorrera in 1971, I'm convinced was a very, very significant and important event in human history, and I think that it will be recognized as such by more than just the fringe sometime in the not too distant future, perhaps. So anyway, we've got another hour or so left of the program, and I thought I would talk a little bit about my own experiences. Whenever I hear Terrence talk, I always relate it back to my own life and how it's affected me, and how I got into the situation that I'm in, which is an interesting one. But you know, but I want to talk about experience. I think that that's the most important thing. So I'm not interested really in telling you how it is or anything like that. I'm just going to tell you how it is for me, and a little bit about how what happened to me happened, and you know how I got where I am. So, first of all, with regard to shamanism, I don't call myself a shaman. I don't know anybody that does, who's really doing it right. It's not about the name calling or you know having a title or anything like that. What I do is I practice shamanic technique or techniques that have been taught to me, shared with me, discovered by me, you know, over the course of my own adventure here, right? So I think, first of all, it's important to recognize that the word shamanism in our time now has become sort of bastardized, I think, as if it's religious. And I don't believe that shamanism is a religion. I believe it's a set of practices and techniques that a person from any ideology can embark upon. Some with more success than others, of course. You know, some with more natural ability than others. Some are called to it. Some find it serendipitously. Some try to get it and can't. So it's a mysterious sort of area, and it's a mystery to me too. But I'll tell you just a little bit about my own experiences, and so you have a better feel for why I'm so interested in the thoughts of Terrence and Dennis from all those years ago, and many of the other things that we talk about on this radio program, okay? All right, so shamanic technique, there are many ways to approach it. The idea, in most cases, is to perturb the mind, alter the consciousness, and go into a state of mind, a state of consciousness, where communication and information transfer can occur between yourself and sources of information that might not normally be available in normal consciousness. There are lots of different ways that people have gone about it. drumming, rhythm, dance, breathing exercise, yoga, that sort of thing, ordeal in the wilderness. And then there's also the plant-induced variety, which is the one that I'm most interested in. So anyway, I wasn't, I'm 43 going on 44 years old. And although I've had a lot of interest in, fringe type subjects for many, many years, only in the last 10 years or so did I start to integrate anything of that nature into my own life and sort of clarify my own worldview. You know, I was a pretty screwed up person, frankly. If you go back 10 years in 1998, I was living in Denver, Colorado. I didn't have a job, although I had had jobs before, and I'm quote-unquote educated. You know, I have a degree in mathematics and physics, and I speak good German, and I was employable, but I didn't have a job, didn't want one, was living with a girl who was the daughter of an oil magnate and had all kinds of money, so I was essentially living off of her, although we shouldn't have stayed together as long as we did, but I just sort of hung in there for the money, and we lived in a really nice house and all that stuff. So, but anyway, I was just about to be thrown out by her after she would discover that I had been sleeping with another woman. And so then that was basically the beginning of the end for me. That actually happened. And I had nowhere to live, and I had no money, and I didn't have a job, and I really wasn't interested in working, but I knew that I would have to probably, but I didn't have the means to begin like immediately. So anyway, I was sort of in deep trouble. And were it not for a woman whose name, I'll just call her Lucy, who is actually an angel. You know, there are actually angels that live in the human realm. And anyway, she is an angel. And with her help and goodwill, I was able to manage a little place that she owned and live in a little apartment above the office there and sort of get back on my feet before I embarked on whatever would be the next, the next phase of my life. But I had realized that the way that I had been treating people, the way that I had been conducting my life was just not, it wasn't working out for me, and so I decided that I would, try to do something different and try to get my act together. So anyway, I got a job and, started working again in the corporate world and all that. And at the same time, though, I began to get more and more interested in indigenous culture. And at the same time, Terrence McKenna and I were just becoming friends and correspondence through the newly blossoming internet. And so I was interested in what he had to say, and I wasn't familiar with any psychedelic plants at the time. I didn't know anything about it, virtually was clueless about the topic. And anyway, that was, say, 1998. Well, anyway, I mentioned earlier this wonderful Lakota man and grandfather, Kanji Sapa, grandfather Silo Black Crow. Well, around the same time, I was, it's weird how things happen, but somehow I was invited to go to an elders gathering of Lakota grandfathers and grandmothers, Hopi, Cherokee, and a number of other tribes in Denver, and it was a privilege to be invited to the thing. And I'm not even sure how it happened. It was through Kent Stedman, in a weird way. Kent and I were becoming closer friends, again, had met in 1997 or so. Anyway, I went to this Lakota and other indigenous tribal gathering of elders, and I met CeeLo Black Crow, I met Wallace Black Elk, and Grandfather Chester, Grandfather Clifford, Grandmother Connie, Grandfather Martin, Gashwizioma, the Hopi. And over the next 2 years or so, I got deeply involved in that culture and discovered my own heritage in Lakota, which is a whole nother story, you know. Even though I'm apparently, you know, if you see me, I appear to, you know, I'm a Caucasian person, but you know, we're all mixed up, and you may not know what you got in there, but and it's not frankly that important, but you know, you gravitate towards things that make you feel good or that resonate with you. And what I was hearing and what I was learning from my Lakota grandfathers was resonating with me, and it was helping me, you know, get to a different place that I couldn't define, but I knew that I liked the way it felt, and so I just sort of kept on with it. In Lakota shamanism, it's not particularly plant-based. Lakota use the drum, song, sweat lodge, prayer, and the sacred pipe, Chinupa. The prayers that I learned, the words that I learned, the sweat experiences that I've had, the songs that I've learned, and the power of the pipe, of the sacred Chinupa, have all been things that I've sort of incorporated into my own technique. But, you know, it's also unique, and you take things from different places and put it together, hopefully, and see you know, see how it works for you, basically, right? And it's a unique individual thing, and it can require, you know, a tremendous amount of work and effort. It requires, you know, a commitment, and only the individual can decide how much they're willing to commit. But the rewards are equally balanced, you know. It's like any relationship. You get out what you put in. So, anyway, fast forward to about 2003. My wife Ashley and I met in 1999, and she was the first woman that I had been honest with, you know, my whole life, basically. And, you know, told her all about my background. She was someone that I could actually tell the truth to. And she still loves me and accepts me, you know, the way I am, regardless of what that means. I mean, it's unconditional love in the truest sense. And I'm blessed, you know, that I found her. And anyway, in 1999, I was just sort of coming out of this deep, dark place that I had been in essentially since my teen years. And I met Ashley and fell in love. And then, well, you know, just sort of did what came naturally. And over the course of a couple of years, in 2001, we got married. And we're married in Denver. That was a trip. We got married 11 days after the World Trade Centers came crashing down. We got married on September 22nd, 2001. And it was a wild time on the whole planet, I guess. And, you know, we were planning on traveling, and a lot of people were planning on coming to visit us and all this stuff. But we did eventually, on the 22nd, or the day after we got married, we went to Europe and had a wonderful vacation there. But anyway, we moved here to Missouri shortly after that in mid-2002. And there was something about moving back to this part of the country. I'm from the Chicago area originally, but being in Missouri, although for some people it might not be, that great, for me it's amazing. There's something about the land here that feels right for me and that I love. And in March of 2003, a couple months earlier, I had just learned that Ashley was pregnant with our first son, and I didn't know it was a son at the time, but at any rate, she told me, hey, I'm pregnant, we're going to have a baby. And we were living in this apartment in Columbia, Missouri, and I thought, oh man, well, now I got to find a place, to live. I need to buy a home. I need a place where we can be, safe and secure and stable. And so So every weekend for months, I would go out and drive around the countryside and look for, potential places to live. And I knew that we wanted to live out of the city somewhere in a country-type setting and someplace, without a lot of regulation and without a lot of people, someplace where we could spread out a little bit, someplace we could be with more of a natural setting with trees and animals and water. Anyway, on the 17th of March, 2003, I was driving on a road, a country road, just outside of Roachport, Missouri. And I passed something in the road and didn't quite catch what it was, just sort of saw it out of the corner of my eye. And I was going, 55, 60 miles an hour, whatever, just down this road. And I don't know, I just thought it was something in the road. It just caught my eye, a clump of hay or dirt or an animal perhaps, I didn't know. Right? And seen plenty of that stuff before. But for whatever reason, I could not get this out of my mind. And I drove for another half mile or so and finally just stopped and turned around because, it was this voice in my head that just kept saying, maybe I need to go back there and see what that was. So I did, and what I found was a red-tailed hawk that was laying in the middle of the road and was dead and had a snake in its mouth, halfway consumed. The snake was, I'd say, the back half of the snake, the tail half of the snake was outside of the bird, and then the head half of the snake, was inside the bird's gullet, stomach, etc. They were both dead. The snake was dead and the bird was dead. They weren't broken, though. The bird was not damaged. It didn't appear to have been hit by a car or anything like that. It was still fully intact, and it was still warm. It had just happened. Must have just happened, whatever it was that happened. And maybe the bird choked on the snake, or maybe the snake bit the bird from the inside. I'm not sure what happened, right? Anyway, there was something about the event that that was profound and overwhelming, actually, to me. And sort of drove me for the first time in my life outside of the sweat lodge and outside of the company of my grandfathers into a state of consciousness that I was not familiar with. And I wasn't quite sure what was happening, but I knew that bird was important. And so, anyway, I removed the snake from the bird's mouth and took it over, set it down by an old ash tree, and said a little prayer for the snake. And then I wrapped up this bird in a blanket and put it in the back of my truck and called my grandfather, Wambichikala, Wallace Black Elk, because I wanted his advice on what to do. And so, anyway, what Wallace said was, you take that bird and you go somewhere special for you, and you take it there and you release it back to the grandfathers and back to the grandmother earth, and you do whatever you do, but you make it sacred. And I said, what do you mean make it sacred? And he said, you make it sacred, Mike. Whatever that means to you. And so, I did that. I went to a place that's special to me. And I took the bird there. And I made it sacred. And that was 5 years ago. And it was in March. Well, shortly before the death of both Grandfather Wallace and Grandfather CeeLo in the following winter. But at any rate, that was the beginning of sort of my story, at least a recent part of it. And I'll tell you a little bit more when we come back from this break, okay? And see if I can make some sense of it, okay? All right, it's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. And here's another song from D Numbers. This one's called Harmagas. Once again, it's Mike. It's a pleasure to be with y'all. Hope you're enjoying the program. KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. It's Radio Orbit. Numbers, once again from Light Parade. Great stuff. Thanks for the music, you guys. It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM, about 25 minutes or so before the hour of 2 a.m. on now the 4th of March, 2008. March 4th, as it were. Okay, so that's a story about my hawk. And, you know, the hawks have been my friends ever since, and I see them where other people don't see them, and they cross my path more often than I can tell you. But after that experience, I became much more serious about practicing my Lakota ritual and ceremonial things that I had been taught. And I recognized it, at least in my own view, as a calling of sorts, and you're on the right track sort of thing. So very shortly after the hawk experience, we found our home, which was very close to where this thing actually occurred. And we bought our home and have lived there now since August of 2003. And it is a couple of miles from the Missouri River on what I consider ancestral Plains Indians land. I mean, this is all of this was around here. You know, this is Lakota country. This is Plains Indians territory right here where I'm talking to you from, Columbia, Missouri, and this whole surrounding area. So anyway, I feel fortunate to have a small piece of land that I can steward and take care of and partner with in the tradition of my grandfathers. So after we got our place, I built a medicine wheel out in the back, a fire pit with a traditional Lakota medicine wheel where I say my prayers and do my thing. And, you know, this whole time, as I've been going through all these different experiences, you know, Terrence and Dennis were in the back of my mind. And I had been friends with Terrence since 1997 or so, had read all of his books, had listened to all of his tapes, and was very familiar with his ideas. But I had never done what he said to do. You know, I had never done what he suggested, and that was the mushroom. And I certainly had never done it in the way that he said to do it. You know, the method is very important, and the set and the setting, of course, hugely important. And the difference between, you know, a toe stub, you know, or the greatest orgasm of your life or something like that, you know, the differences between these experiences that can be brought on by the same substance is just unfathomable almost. So at any rate, in April of 2005, I decided that I would try to incorporate the mushroom into the Lakota ritual that I do. It's the first time I'd ever done it. So I did, and I had a remarkable experience. I didn't do it again until April of 2006. I relayed the experiences of April 2006 to you all in a program that I did in June of last year. If you're interested in hearing the sort of play-by-play about what happened to me in April of 2006, you can listen to that program. I think it was June 25th of last year. At any rate, April of 2006, my whole life changed. And among other things, I was given my chinupa. And essentially everything that I have done since then has been because of and through my grandfather's, with the assistance or the symbiotic partnership with the psilocybin mushroom. The things that have happened to me, the experiences that I've had in the last 3 years have been unlike anything that I could have ever imagined. And the significance of what happened to Terrence and Dennis all those years ago in 1971 becomes more and more apparent to me every day, to the point where, you know, I feel it's necessary to share it with you guys. Because these are experiences, you know, not words from somebody else's book or from somebody telling a story that, you know, that I don't know is true or false. These are my own experiences, and I know they're true. And I can only say that that they are intensifying to the point where you wonder how much longer the thing can hold together before something gives way and something new takes its place, whatever that might be. And Terrence alluded to lots of different things in the talk that he gave earlier tonight. But there are a couple of things that that come through for me. First one is that there is something guiding the long-term evolution of this planet. The part that humans play in it, you know, I'm not willing to fathom that, but it does appear, at least, that we play a key role. And our role in the future will be defined by how we play it out right now in the present, really. But I do believe that there are forces at work that are not normally accepted in the realms of, you know, modern society. The idea of a spirit world and the idea that the spirit world can actually be efficacious on three-dimensional reality, well, that's a pretty far cry for most people. But if you look at the religions of the world, I mean, unless they're all just completely foolish, well, once you get past the dogma of what they're doing these days, what they've turned into after 5-10,000 years of twistedness. But at the root of all of them is that there is some entity, some creative being, some force, some God that is not from the system of nature, but that created the system of nature. And we live within this prison, actually, of the natural world. We are always confounded and confronted by death, by suffering, and the duality of nature, life and death, and everything in between. The primary goal of shamanism, two things, at least the two primary things that I was taught, and they're relatively simple. They are to help and to heal. And much of this comes from the natural world. One of my friends and I talk a lot about, the significance of nature, because I'm a nature person, and I am so deeply connected to the plants and the animals and the smallest critters. Spiders are just among my favorites, and it really doesn't matter if it's a living thing. I tend to dig it. I may not love them to the point where I don't like chiggers, but I have a certain level of respect for all of these different life forms and recognize them as medicine. There's hawk medicine, there's eagle medicine, there's crow medicine, there's possum medicine, there's skunk medicine, there's spider medicine. The Ikdomi medicine is powerful, right? And then, of course, there's plant medicine, cannabis, psilocybin, ayahuasca, peyote. It depends on the methodology and the background of the initiate, that determines what they use, how they use it, and how good they are at it. How good's your mojo? There are different levels of magic. We talked about magic last week with Richard Allen Miller. Well, the true shaman is a magician, in my opinion. And I love Paul Laffoley's definition: a non-rational method of engineering, a way to affect reality, bend fate, but through non-rational means. And so, putting those things together and remembering the goals of to help and to heal, well, that's sort of what's gotten me where I am. And since I combined psilocybin with my Lakota ceremonial ritual work, with my spirit guides, with my grandfathers, everything I do is because of and through my grandfathers. I make decisions with their guidance, as I said before. And I honor them and respect them. And I thank them for my chinupa. And it's almost 2 o'clock in the morning, so I say their names now so everybody hears. Hehaka Sapa, Wamli Chikala, Kanji Sapa, Tasuka Witko, Tatanka Iotaki, Geatle, Tecumseh, my grandfathers, Pila Mayaya Michinupa, Wowichaka Milala, Wowichaka. So, what good is it, That's the question, Is it for what good? Well, the first thing is for me. I began all this stuff because I wanted to get okay. I wanted to feel okay. I wanted to feel better about myself and my life than I felt about it before. And I wanted to find something that worked for me. the next thing, you know, once you take care of yourself, is to try to help those around you. You know, so first you, I've talked about this before, you know, the idea of circles and concentric circles that begin essentially at your heart. The first circle is right around your own heart, the center of your being. And you get your heart right, you know, and then you expand outward from there. And then maybe you can help your friends and your family, you know, if they want it. You know, it's not about proselytizing. It's not about preaching. It's not about, you know, pushing stuff down people's throats. It's about doing the best you can for yourself and others who, you know, are interested in it. Now, the amazing thing about shamanic technique is that it is particularly cultural. If you look back, you know, over the literature, the historical literature, you'll find that a shaman is typically only effective within the boundaries of his own culture or her own culture. You know, we should clarify that. A shaman is not a man or a woman. It can be either or. Shamanism is a practical set of techniques that can be practiced by a man or a woman. Again, you know, to different levels of success, depending on your level of commitment and the level of perhaps, you know, God-given ability or whatever, just like anything. Some people can play the flute really well, you know. So, anyway, we now have a global culture. And it's my belief and my great hope that there will be shamans that arise on the scene that can function effectively in the global culture. Because now there's enough information about the rest of the world to utilize in the shamanic state. The reason that a traditional shaman is only effective in his or her culture is because that's where their information set comes from. That's where their data comes from, right? So the shamans in Central America had a very difficult time when the European colonization came at them. I mean, you heard the story of the Putumayo rubber boom, you know, destroyed and decimated many of those populations in Central and South America. While the shamans were not effective against the onslaught of the European invaders, well, the reason that they were ineffective was because they were not familiar with the culture. They could not function effectively in that culture. Their shamanic ability was limited to their own culture. Well, now we have a global culture. And there are people who are familiar with many, many different aspects of the way the world works. And if those people can employ shamanic technique, I believe that it is possible to bring health and healing to the global culture, to the entire planet, through non-rational methods of engineering, through magic. And so it's sort of a lofty goal, but certainly there is someone out there, some two people out there, that are willing to push it hard enough, to cry uncle loud enough, to actually bring about the changes that we're all hoping will come and bring us a new world, one of health and healing and compassion and dignity, honor, respect, and balance, and truth. For all of those who have come before us, for all of those who follow, for all of our children. Aho. All right. It's Mike. You've been listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Time to say goodbye. I love you all. Thanks very much for listening to the program. Once again, this is D Numbers. This is called Adios Gracias. I'll talk to you all next week. Thanks again for listening.